Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, by the way. This is my first bilingual conference, and I've fallen terribly short since I can't understand or speak a word of the second language, so I apologize for that. I will do my best, and hopefully you'll get the gist. It's also wonderful to be among people who think very hard about cities and local government in general, especially in a comparative way, so it's very exciting to be here. So I'm talking about today the relationship between cities, capital, and constitutions, though the constitution part is not as much of a focus of this paper as the larger project of which this paper is a part. We've had some of that conversation previously. Thad talked about mobile capital. Avner talked about redistribution. So I think this fits together nicely with those papers. So the larger project examines the problem of mobile capital for cities, and it's animated by two related questions. The first is there anything that cities can do in the face of economic restructuring, or are they just kind of leaves in the wind, that they just blow along with the economic tides? And how much regulatory autonomy do cities actually have? And that relates to the question of how much regulatory autonomy do we actually want them to have? So that's the normative question. This is a part of the larger globalization debate, which is to what extent can small-scale, territorially based governments actually govern, and to what extent do we see them as democratic entities with the full panoply of kind of democratic agency. In the legal literature, we often see this question as one about city power. Do we want cities to have more power or less? And that's usually vis-a-vis some higher level government, a provincial or state government or the central government. And we see this in legal doctrine, at least in the United States. We see it in cases about subsidies for industry, subsidies for attracting capital, the redistribution of monies from place-based capital to mobile capital. And so these come up in those ways. So we start with sort of a conventional view, which is that capital dictates the range of choices available to local governments and their citizens. Cities are thus in a continuous competition to attract high-value persons and businesses. Cities can therefore improve their economic prospects by adopting good policies, and those good policies tend to be minimal redistributive taxation, relatively low levels of economic regulation, and policies that attract and subsidize mobile capital. And then the fourth sort of prong of this is that city is limited, its internal politics, this is Paul Peterson, is essentially the city is limited to developmental issues, and most important decisions, particularly large redistributive decisions, have to be made at higher level governments. So that's a kind of a conventional wisdom that I'm against which I am writing. So this essay is a small piece of that. It challenges the limited cities story, and it does so by looking at places in which we've seen cities engaged in redistributive activities that you might not have predicted they'd be able to engage in. And so the paper is descriptive in that it describes these areas in which this is taking place. And then it tries to articulate why cities are able to do that, what the political economy story that is behind these things. So let me first just talk quickly about the areas in which we see some of this activity that at least neoclassical economics tells us we shouldn't see, and then I'll talk about the structures that enable this. So there are three areas I look at. One is local minimum wage ordinances. The second are these things called community benefits agreements, and the third is anti-chain store laws. And these are areas in which cities in a fairly modest way are attempting to redistribute capital within them, within themselves, put conditions on capital once it's here or as it's coming in, or exclude certain kinds of investment altogether. There are other ways that cities can control their economic fates, or at least there are other ways that we might think about them controlling capital. Thad talked about some yesterday, that is actually ownership of productive resources. Now, we don't live in a world in which that takes place on a grand scale. That is, we live in a world in which private economic enterprise is the dominant mode. That doesn't mean it has to be the dominant mode, but I'm talking about kind of this middle range of more modest efforts. So local minimum wage ordinances, I'll start with. About 122 U.S. cities have adopted a living or minimum wage ordinance. And these ordinances are often adopted in relation to low-wage service industries, hotels, hospitals, and other low-wage sectors. Often those sectors are dependent on place, that is, the hotels are place-specific, universities are place-specific, hospitals are often place-specific. And so what labor in the United States has found it valuable to try to create minimum conditions, in this case minimum wage conditions, in those sectors. The big legal question in those cases, in the minimum wage ordinance cases, is whether municipalities are permitted to adopt minimum wage ordinances at all. That is, whether it's within their home rule powers, and there have been some cases about that. The economic question is whether the minimum wage ordinance causes businesses to flee across the border, and that's a serious question, and we can talk about that as well. The second area is community benefits agreements. These are new in the United States. They're kind of like clawback provisions that you see in other contexts. They started in California. They've reached places like New York now. And these are interesting. They are privately negotiated agreements between anti-poverty and labor public interest groups with incoming developers, often on large-scale development projects in the city. And the idea is to trade political support or not opposing the project in the local land use process, to trade that for certain conditions on the development. That is, to pay a minimum wage to your workers, to hire locally, to set aside lands for public use or community use, to limit displacement, that kind of thing. And so they bypass the usual land use process in the city. That is, they are between two private actors, and they take the form of a contract. And there's a real question whether that's enforceable at all. But putting that aside, they attempt to use political leverage as I said, bypass City Hall, essentially, because the community groups don't trust City Hall. And the legal or policy question here, the legal question is whether they're enforceable. The policy question here is whether this is extortion. It's just political extortion, and some have said this. In some cases, these do not work very well. The developer sets up the front groups, community front groups, and negotiates with them, which is like negotiating with yourself. Or they set it up and it's a bribe. So in New York City, you've seen more of that. In California, they seem to work better. They're an interesting development, though, in the local government development process. The third is anti-chain store laws. You're probably familiar with these. This is exclusion altogether. It's often spearheaded by labor groups, again, who are resisting, say, Walmart from coming in or some other big box store. I call this land use unionism. That is, it's a effort for unions to exercise some political power at the very local stage through the land use process, which you haven't seen very much before. And this is partially out of necessity. The labor movement in the United States and elsewhere, I think, but particularly in the United States, has failed at the national level, or at least it's been diluted quite substantially. at the national level. So there's not a lot of action there or sympathy for labor rights there. We saw this in the states too recently with all these efforts to get rid of collective bargaining for public sector unions. One question we would raise about these kinds of policies is whether they're exclusionary in a way that we don't like. That is, there's some distributional consequences of keeping a Walmart out because of it does actually bring some cheap goods to local consumers and some jobs for that matter. In any case, all these things are kind of an example of a decentralized labor movement and anti-poverty movement that has seen some opportunities at the local level. I've called this a certain amount of regulatory localism that you see here. So why are cities able to do this? What are the characteristics of this localist regulatory order? What resources are available to cities to be able to make these policy choices? So I identify three, and these again are counter trends to the usual convergence story, which is that cities will become business friendly over time and that they will all adopt similar policies. So the first resource is an ideology and discourse of economic localism. And this has a long pedigree in the United States. It goes through the anti-corporatism, anti-monopolism of the progressive era and the pre-progressive era of the agrarians, the Jacksonians, the progressive decentralists. There was a significant anti-chain store movement in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. Louis Brandeis, as justice on the Supreme Court, was a big advocate of anti-chain store tax laws. And it's a rhetoric and ideology that's hostile to, not to business per se, but to big mobile business. That is, it's worried about scale. It's explicitly decentralist. That is, it argues that citizenship requires, in classic kind of Republican form, citizenship requires economic independence. Individuals should not be clerks in stores. They should be owners of their productive enterprises. And it has both left and right-leaning valence. That is, the left-leaning valence it favors local regulation and active government involvement in decentralizing. It's got a right-leaning valence in that it's hostile to cosmopolitanism and global governance and can be quite reactionary in certain ways. We see this in this case, Kelo versus New London, which was a case in the United States about whether you could take someone's home through the exercise of eminent domain in order to essentially give it over to a large pharmaceutical company on the hope that they would generate economic development in the city of New London, Connecticut. The political reaction to that was unexpected, but it did evoke a kind of response from what Robert Johnston would call the democratic anti-capitalist middle class, who got quite upset about this. So that's the first, the ideology and discourse of economic localism. The second, as I've mentioned already in part, is translocal networks. So the way power is exercised in these CBAs and in the minimum wage campaigns is you get national labor and anti-poverty organizations coming in to help out locals. Sometimes that's not help, or we should ask whether that's help, or it's pursuing an agenda of the national entities. So we do ask whether what the local public is. The local public is and what its aims are, and if those are consistent with the aims of sort of the larger organizations. But it does serve as a resource for locals who are resisting the influx of capital or its escape. And then the third element is what I call sticky capital in the paper, which is that capital is differently mobile. And what cities have found is that with the rise of agglomeration economies and clustering, firms and labor sometimes need to be in certain places. We've seen this with the service industries. There's a claim that this happens with knowledge industries and other kinds of industries. And that means there's economic leverage that can be used in the process of trying to extract concessions at the local level, because industries are not as mobile as we might have thought. There's also the decline of the nation state as the locus of economic activity, the rise of the metropolitan economy. So let me finish very quickly with some potential policy or political implications of this. For those that adopt a kind of competitive city paradigm, this is worrisome that cities can do this or that interest groups within cities can do it, because the competitive city paradigm is supposed to be quite beneficial in that it disciplines local governments not to extract too much from existing taxpayers and not to hand too much away, that is, giveaways to capital. And so this may worry some who think that it's actually a good idea for cities to be constrained in certain way. This reflects a skepticism of city power, a skepticism of local democratic power. That doesn't mean the other side is not any less skeptical of local democratic power. What we see in the CBA context is that folks are quite skeptical, at least certain groups in the city are quite skeptical of the exercise of power by city hall or city governors, who are often aligned with growth interests. And so resisting those growth interests through democratic means becomes difficult. So the land use unionism that we see is a reflection of that. That should raise some questions in our mind about how the democratic process works inside cities, and we might be concerned about it. The other point to make is that to the extent there is a possibility of regulatory localism, which again, on neoclassical economics, shouldn't be able to happen, to the extent there's that, it may indicate that cities do have much more room to maneuver in the global economy than we've been led to believe. And that's a positive story, I think. What we worry about are the excesses of that. So you're always worried about the interest groups within the city and who's getting what, who's extracting what from whom. But to the extent that the city can assert some kinds of redistributive programs, social welfare programs, minimum wage, can do so even in the face of globalization and deindustrialization, suburbanization, that I think is a hopeful sign that cities are not just leaves in the wind and that they can challenge the primacy of the nation state as the locus of redistribution and the locus of other important policy efforts. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Top of the head early morning reactions. On the minimum wage stuff, who does it cover and how effective is it really? Because my impression is a lot of times it's, most, maybe not all cases, it applies to government workers and to government contractors.
Yeah.
As opposed to the entire local labor market. And even if it did cover the entire local labor market in theory, I would not believe that's actually what's going on in practice. I mean, you assume whatever what's on the books in New York City, you know, there's thousands of people washing dishes, you know, immigrants for very little. And also in the places where it's enacted, maybe these bigger cities where the going rate is, in a lot of cases, already above the national minimum wage. So my question is, aren't these things really more symbolic victories that really don't have a whole lot of redistributive content at the end of the day on actually affecting?
Yeah.
So what do we know about that? That's one thing. The second thing is, obviously, I'm very interested in the chain store stuff, and but there's the option of no Walmart, Walmart on one side, or mom and pop on the other. But I wonder, is there evidence of people moving towards more high road capitalism style big box retailers, for instance, Costco, which pays people a lot more money, much more stable employee tenure? Is there anything going on and say, let's get that kind of store in, because it can provide the cheaper goods, and it's a totally different labor market experience than what you get with Walmart.
Yeah. So I agree with you. I think the minimum wage stuff is modest, often there in the terms that you're talking about, which is the living wage for contractors and municipal employees. There are surprisingly, though, a number, and I'm not quite sure how many, that try to apply a minimum wage to the whole municipality. I'd have to look back to see which ones those are. Some just try to apply it to big box stores, right? So to the extent Walmart is a big target of a lot of this stuff, they might have kind of a sector or an industry specific, or even a they often phrase it as stores over a certain square footage that act in a particular way, which might get them from not regulating Costco but regulating Walmart, which elicits some legal opposition. There's this, I use an example in this paper, I think it's here, of the Los Angeles imposing this minimum wage on hotel workers in a particular section of the city near the LAX. And that seems like a serious minimum wage effort, and it's a nice example of place-based leverage, because LAX is not going anywhere, and that's where the hotels have to be, and so the city takes advantage of that. But it is a nice example of how a progressive mayor and kind of labor get together and decide this is okay to do, even while the progressive mayor is saying we're going to be a very business-friendly city. So I think these are targeted things, and so they are. And I agree, they're modest in lots of ways. You don't see huge wholesale minimum wage laws across the country that cover a whole city. The chain stores to the mom and pop to the Costco. I think there is some of this. So certainly, labor wants Costco, not Walmart, and so they target particular employers as opposed to others, and so that may leave room for the Costcos to come in, which have better labor practices. That does not respond, though, and this is what's, I think, interesting about it. That doesn't respond to the economic localism, the ideology of economic localism. Costco and Walmart are the same to the mom and pops. And so to the extent you have citizenship concerns and economic independence concerns, Costco doesn't fix that. And that, I think, is a robust ideology, or at least has been. And labor doesn't care, actually. Labor is not interested in actually the small, the kind of decentralist progressivism that I'm talking about. They're just using this as a strategy. But the mom and pops might be, and cities might be, actually.
I found your paper kind of encouraging. It's nice to know that cities can do something. But I was wondering if you'd had a chance to either think about or read studies that might explain the pattern of where these types of initiatives have been successful, especially the living wage laws. I mean, an obvious explanation you would expect maybe would be percent of union members in the area, or perhaps ideology, left-wing voters. I don't know if maybe mercantile cities might be
part of
there's an urban-rural dimension. But I'd be curious to know if there's any patterns there, if there's like a spatial geography of this kind of local justice initiatives.
Yeah.
That was my first question. My second question is, if I remember correctly when I read your paper, you said that, and I don't think you talked about this in the presentation, that maybe cities don't actually have the power to have local minimum wages, and the state could quash this, but this hasn't really been challenged. And I was wondering if I remembered that correctly, because it seems to me if, you know, you have large hotel chains who are being forced to pay a higher minimum wage, that they would certainly do everything they could at the state level to challenge this in the court. So I was wondering, you know, if you could tell me anything about how this has been contested either through the courts or through the political process. I think Frank mentioned yesterday the OMB in Ontario, the Ontario Municipal Board, and this is a non-democratically elected sort of board that can decide against the local zoning and the city council on development issues, and is seen as very anti-democratic. And so I was wondering if there's anything like that in the cases you've looked at.
Yes, yeah, so that's the great questions. The first one, I haven't done the empirical work or seen it, actually. I bet it's out there. on where these things, right? What's the predictors of whether one of these things will get adopted? You see them anecdotally in kind of progressive places like college towns sometimes, where I think they are mostly symbolic in lots of ways. We have seen them or at least efforts to get them in places like Chicago and Los Angeles, as I mentioned. And so we see some of these are alliances with progressive mayors. The CBAs are the community benefits agreements, which sometimes include these living wage provisions for the project. You see in big cities that have resurged, essentially, and where developers actually want to be there now. And so we see those in Denver, Los Angeles, New York, places where you're going to have large-scale developer interest in large parcels, where there might be some city developer cooperation in exercising, the power of eminent domain to get the parcel. So, but there are just not that many. So the sample size is quite small, though they're expanding. But it'd be interesting to see what the geography of that is. There have been challenges to the minimum wage, and I mentioned just a few of them in passing. So in New Mexico, Santa Fe wanted to adopt a minimum wage, and they were permitted to was taken to state court, and the question was under their home rule powers, could they do so? And the answer was yes. New Orleans, however, a minimum wage ordinance was struck down as going beyond New Orleans home rule powers, so they weren't permitted to do so. There are other cases where, so that's the state-local relationship. There's also the federal-local relationship. So there have been challenges under labor preemption. So does the federal statute preempt local minimum wages? And the Ninth Circuit, which is California in the West, has held that they do not preempt that. So that's for California, essentially. Challenges have been brought. There's, I think, 10 years ago, they would have been, these minimum wage ordinances would have been struck down everywhere. That's my feeling about where home rule was. I think more recently, there are courts that are willing to uphold them in the face of contrary state or federal legislation.
Thank you. One question. What's the difference in the U.S. between a living wage and a minimum wage, or are you using it interchangeably? Because I think that in Europe we use the two concepts interchangeably. So if you could answer. The other thing, towards the end of the paper, you say that that the state has been declining as a regulator because of globalism, but to the best of my knowledge, it's the other way around, and it's because there's so much privatization and because there are new fields of regulation, such as the environment, that, the literature that I've read says that the state is becoming a monster of regulation. And therefore, my question relates to the normative aspect of your paper. It would be terrific if the city could replace the state with this regard, but assuming that it won't, won't it be just too much regulation for the little person, you know, who is like, has this load of regulation to carry?
The little city.
Well, if the city also starts regulating so much, what happens with the individual?
Oh, I see. Yeah. That's right. I think the way we use living wage and minimum wage in the states is there is a minimum wage and it's at X dollars, but that's people who argue for a living wage argue that's not enough to keep people out of poverty. So they campaign for living what's been called a living wage. So that's the living wage movement, essentially, is to say there is a outside of the minimum wage that we regulate, that we have. That's we want to be able to top that off. So a living wage might be $11 or $12 in a particular metropolitan region or area or city, whereas the minimum wage is $7 or $5, whatever the minimum wage is set. There's a national minimum wage, and then there's state minimum wages. So that's the difference between those. I think you're right to question this claim that the state is that the nation state is declining. I think there is some evidence, and I'm using this in vis-a-vis their not the fact that they're passing lots of legislation and regulating quite aggressively, but that their effectiveness is at least somewhat muted by the fact that we have now free trade regimes, large global enterprises that can move pretty quickly, right? So I'm talking about the convergence or the race to the bottom in environmental law and various other things. So that indicates to me that nation states are not quite as capable of controlling, and this is part of the capital mobility story. Now, does that mean that cities are more capable of doing this? One would think that they were less capable, but now it turns out the optimistic story, if you embrace the agglomeration story, which is that actually location matters a lot more than we thought it did, then certain cities, and I'm talking about, it might be just a select few, but it might be more, might be actually more capable than the nation state of regulating these entities. That is, they might be in a better position because they can leverage their place-based assets. And the agglomeration economies that come with it, which the nation state doesn't have. They just have, they're regulating away and everybody's moving to China, right? And so you're regulating a lot, but you're impotent, essentially. That's the claim. And so the nation state is becoming less relevant. Local regulation might be becoming more. Now, do I want all this regulation, local, regional, nation state, piling up? No, I would, in fact, I'm a Brandeisian localist, and what Brandeis said was the following, the curse of bigness. He said, gigantism is a problem on the private side and on the public side. So he was against large-scale corporate businesses with huge capital, but he was also against large-scale government that was needed to regulate that large-scale capital. So he would have shrunk both the public sector and the private sector. That's the reactionary side of Brandeis. So he voted against certain New Deal governmental powers on the theory that government was just getting too big. He was worried about oppression from both sides, from the private side and the public side. Now, I don't think we can go back to a world of small-scale business. Right, he wasn't talking about yeoman farmers like Jefferson. He was talking about small-scale business. So you're stuck with large-scale business. And then the question is, does that mean you're stuck with large-scale government, the state, to counteract the power of the large-scale business? And maybe the answer is yes. That's the New Deal. Or maybe the answer is no. You could actually do some decentralization, and cities will have some effect here. I think it's a hope. It's not a... But that's the account.
This pursues exactly what you were saying before. What you advance as an hypothesis about the growth of agglomerate cities and worry about them is advanced, of course, by some boldly as an already proven hypothesis and optimistically advanced. Yeah. So I haven't heard so far in this conference the name Saskia Sassen. You make reference to her in the paper in a parenthetical way, sort of. And I don't think that that's it can't entirely be because people don't like her father. She surely cannot be responsible for.
Yeah, who is her
father? It's recently revealed that the father of Saskia Sassen was the head of the Gestapo in Amsterdam. And and then he ended up in Argentina, and there's actually a picture of her as a very young girl. She can surely not be held responsible for this.
Right.
As a very young girl serving tea to Eichmann in Amsterdam. It's a sad commentary on, you know, the way Europe unfolded after the war and during it. However, she's a progressive thinking person, she's a pro-democrat, and so on, and for her and for the global, maybe it's just Toronto. In Toronto there's a big global cities, you know, a bunch of global cities enthusiasts, including some people who work with me in the city center. For them, and it's not proposed as anti-democratic, it's not even against local, because they think that the non- global cities in a country will profit in a trickle-down sort of way from the successes of their, and so the prescription for them is much, much more power to cities, but much less power to locales within cities.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have something to say about this approach.
Yeah, so as you did notice, so I do cite Sasson for the denationalization thesis, which I think is it's persuasive in lots of ways. I'm not on board completely with it. I think it's a possibility, not a proven fact. I do think one could interpret this as just a global city phenomena, and then you're just talking about three or four cities or 10 in the whole world or something like that. In which case, it's not very robust. It would reflect the power of New York, Chicago, L.A., and Tokyo and London.
And 20 or 30.
Yeah.
And
so.
And she thinks they are the movers and shakers.
Yeah. So I think that, my view is what's interesting is you always have a hierarchy of cities, and that's quite interesting, and they work in conjunction with one another. So I try to think of in terms of systems of cities. She does too, I think, to some degree. So systems of cities. Now, I don't know what the mechanism is by which the great global cities move prosperity to these other cities. You may just have global cities and nobody else, a lot of suburbs, right? And just the Richmonds, the Trentons, the Camdens, the Buffaloes, those cities will just decline inevitably. Now, in terms of power to these cities and not power to, say, neighborhoods within the cities or wards within the cities or interests within the cities, she's somewhat critical about the sociology of these global cities. I'm surprised that other people are not as critical or boosters for those kinds of places, because she worries about the economic inequality that results and the bifurcation both between cities and within the city. And what she seems to see, I think, is that there's going to be massive inequalities in these places, and you'd have to figure out a way to resolve those. And maybe global cities with a progressive mayor would resolve it with a minimum wage, because they can exercise power on behalf of the lower incomes who are affected by this globalization. But it's not clear that's the case. And it is clear that if the city is pursuing a growth agenda and they perceive themselves as a global city, they might neglect that group of folks. So this is Mayor Bloomberg saying it's perfectly fine if Manhattan is only rich people. Now, then he realized that you need immigrants to drive your city. So he's actually realized that's not what we want to do.
What she wants, I think, is welfare state cities, and that's what I think she wants to hit out the also it's a little muted because, like you say, it's the global city regions like Florida that she's interested in. So Toronto counts as a global city. But Toronto includes such places as Buffalo.
Yes.
I mean, it's...
yeah, so this is... The lawyers, as lawyers, we pay a lot of attention to the jurisdictional city as opposed to the economic city. And there's a real question of how those two inter... And so I flip back and forth. So sometimes I'm talking about the jurisdictional city, and sometimes I'm talking about the economic city. The jurisdictional city is a different thing. And so you might be talking about global city regions, but that's not that helpful when you talk about what powers the city as a jurisdictional entity to should have vis-a-vis the other municipalities there or the region.
So in our exchange, you were mentioning that one of the concerns with self-determination for cities was the sort of democratic deficit at various levels, possibility of more corruption, perhaps politicians of less caliber. So I'm wondering, and my response to you, political philosophers engage in what is known as normative sociology and normative political science, which is that we invoke facts as we think they ought to be,
right.
rather than facts as they are, which is very convenient because it makes it all very neat, but
very.
Tends to have problems when it comes to confronting reality.
Yeah, yeah.
So my question is, in the cities that you've studied that have taken on measures like this. Is there some kind of an uptick in, say, for example, easily identifiable indexes like participation of voters in municipal elections or participation of... Is there any suggestion that as the regulatory activity of cities increases, so does the democratic deficit as measured by various indexes decrease?
Decrease, yeah.
It would be nice.
Yeah, it'd be nice. I don't know. I don't know. Right. I haven't, I also don't do empirical work at all. This is anecdotal work. That's what this, so lawyers, we take something and we say, oh, here's a pattern. I don't know. That would be interesting. And your response was the right one, which is that, well, if you give cities more authority to decide hard issues, then actually people start paying attention.
Right.
The problem with that in a federal system or any system, frankly, is that once they start paying attention, the state in the United States, the state or the province and the national government will also start to pay attention. So San Francisco recognizes same-sex marriage. Immediately, the state goes crazy, and so does the national. So you get legislation that overwhelms that. And then federalism is supposed to figure out who gets to do what. But cities do not have an independent constitutional status of any kind. And so unless they have very, very robust powers, many of which we wouldn't want them to have, maybe, it's going to be hard for them to withstand the preemptive effect of the state and the national coming in. So anything that is serious, the state or the nation tries to get their hands on.
Could you just say a little more about how community benefits agreements fit into the regulatory localism?
Yeah.
A, and then B, I mean, maybe it's part of the same question. What normatively are your thoughts between, you know, wonderful agreements, really lousy agreements?
Yeah.
So two parts.
Yeah. So how does it fit in? It's interesting because it's not, because it's private side, or at least ostensibly private side, it's not the city actually doing it, but the city's obviously involved, and so there are kind of three actors, the community groups, the city folks, the planners within the city, and then the developer, and it's kind of a three-part negotiation, which would be interesting to see. This is something you could say something quite a bit about, how these things are negotiated. But they are a particular form of regulation. They're not through the zoning process, right? They're not through exactions, right? They're through this private contract, which is supposedly enforceable by the private community groups that entered into it with the developer. So it's regulatory in that way. It's not regulatory in the sense that it's a statute or it's dictated by a government. So which ones are good and which ones are bad or something like that? What we've seen is that in New York, where the developers have tried to head this off by essentially bribing the local elites, that has resulted in what seem to be bad community benefits agreements. And the good ones seem to be ones... As a normative, right now, as an empirical matter, you've got to decide, right? If the local community groups got something, yeah, but who care, right? Who care? They got housing, or they got a public space, or a park, or something. That's great. What people worry about is who the representatives on the privates on the community side are, and that's up front. That's the hard work, which is who are the stakeholders? Who do you get involved, and how do you decide who those people are? And they're in fact just lawyers who've sort of come up with this stuff, and their hardest job is figuring out who should be in the room to represent that side. And then, is that a fair agreement? Well, you've got to figure out if those people are representative.
Just a follow-up question on that one. For the CBAs in New York, you were talking about the front groups for developers, right? My understanding of CBAs is that the community groups enter into the agreements and then forbear from opposing in the regulatory process. So if you have a group that is a front group for developers, why would that cause community groups to forbear in the regulatory process? I don't understand how the the mechanism works.
Benoit Frat, PhD candidate law, University of Ottawa. I was wondering if you see a link between the ordinances you discussed and local foreign policy ordinances adopted by U.S. cities in the past. I'm thinking about ordinances banning contracting with companies having an interest in Burma or South Africa apartheid. So a link with the actors behind the ordinances or the ultimate motives? Thank you.
So real quick, Hoy, so Front Group might be overstating it. It is that they identify who might be opposed on the front end, get them to kind of create a group that didn't exist, right? These are kinds of, and promise them certain benefits, which co-opts the community itself. Now that again might not be a terrible thing if they're actually getting something, but to the extent that it's a local politico or someone who you don't trust to actually represent the neighborhood, then you worry about that. On the back end, you worry that it's just extortion of the developer. I know we don't worry about developers that much in this room, but to the extent you're just worried about a kind of extortion, a political extortion, that might be bad, and you might want all this stuff to run through the actual real regulatory process, that is the land use process with representatives from the city, et cetera. So the side deals raise some questions. The local foreign policy is really interesting. So again, there have been these efforts, and there's other local regulatory things too, like the same-sex marriage and employment discrimination laws. It's not just redistributive. Cities are trying lots of different things. What happens in the local foreign policy context is the Supreme Court of the United States strikes these things down because they're essentially preempted by the nation. So we know for sure that cities can't do a lot of this stuff, even if they want to divest. Now, they could probably divest their assets, but they can't order anybody else in their jurisdiction to do it. They can't stop somebody from investing, like Burma investing in their city. That would be a problem, too. But this would all trench on the foreign affairs powers of the nation. And so we see the limits of their power in that context.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.